Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. In a few last Dharma talk, we are discussing about Four Noble Truths. The first of the Four Noble Truths is the Noble Truth of Suffering, at which the Buddha said one must thoroughly understand it. That truth, we must really thoroughly understand it. In his first sermon, he opened as thus. Okay. Birth is suffering. Old age and decay is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain and grief is suffering. Being with person of dislike is suffering. Being apart from person that you like is suffering. Not attaining one what one wishes in here is, which is unattainable, is suffering. In brief, five aggregates of clinging is suffering. So those are the suffering. As a definition for the Noble Truth of Suffering. And we have discussed all these in details. The last one, the five aggregates of clinging, that is the main point, the key point in this, the first Noble Truth. Because that is a walking model. Start. So the five aggregates of clinging is, one is aggregates of materiality or rupa. Okay. Aggregates of feeling and sensations, vedana. Aggregates of perception, sanya. And aggregates of mental formation, sankhara, and aggregates of consciousness, which is vijnana. Those are the five aggregates. And we have talked lengthily so that now we understand. This five aggregates of clinging is anything and everything of the world of living beings, anything and everything in the universe of living beings. That is what's about. And we have discussed in at length. Now we intellectually and philosophically understand what the Noble Truth of Suffering is. In short, what suffering is, we have discussed about it. And as I have said, the last one is the most important one among all the suffering because it covers anything and everything. And also it becomes a walking model for the release from suffering. Why has it become a working model? So what are we practicing? What are we doing? Okay. To be able to eliminate all physical and mental suffering. We are practicing or we are doing vipassana, insight meditation. Of course, we follow the pure vipassana route. In other words, we we practice vipassana using satipatthana as a tool, foundation of mindfulness as a tool, or in other words, pure vipassana. We practice vipassana. So in a very precise way, what do we do when we practice vipassana? What we do is we observe the five aggregates. That's it. Vipassana is observing five aggregates. And what is five aggregates? Five aggregates is suffering. Five aggregates is life. Five aggregates is what we call existence of a being. So that's what vipassana does, or that's what we are doing. We are observing the five aggregates. How do we observe? We observed at every present moment, any and every present moment, whatever aggregates that is arising at that moment, we observed it. And we know how to observe precisely and correctly. So we won't go into it. We observe whatever aggregates that is arising at the present moment with precision and correctness, vipassana. By observing, what do? We are observing suffering. And why are we observing suffering? So that we can experientially know what suffering is, what dukkha is, what the first noble truth is, to thoroughly understand. We already understood intellectually and philosophically. Now we are doing vipassana so that we can experientially understand what dukkha is, what the first noble truth is. That's what we are doing. So, as the five aggregates is anything and everything, and as we are observing the five aggregates, we don't say we are observing this aggregate or that aggregate, because those encompass everything. So, whatever is arising at the moment, you just simply observed. If you feel a tension, observe the tension. If you feel the stiffness, observe the stiffness, or hot or cold. If you feel any sensations, pleasant or unpleasant, observe it. And if you feel any emotional states, observe it. So when you're observing this hot and cold and hard and soft and tension and things, that is observing the aggregates of the body, okay, rupa khanda, you're observing it. So, but we don't say, I'm observing rupa khanda. You simply observe exactly what that specific object arising at that moment, rupa khanda. You are observing rupa khanda. And also, mostly in our path with the satipatthana method, pain, unpleasant sensation is the most prominent. That's the way it's structured. The reason it's structured in such a way is what we really want to know is dukkha, suffering. And the obvious way to understand dukkha is to go straight into the pain. Because pain, every one of us agree this is suffering. That's why we go right into that unpleasant sensation. So observe the pain. And then, of course, we know when you reach to a certain level, you experience pleasant sensations. and also at the higher level neutral sensation. Whenever you are observing these sensations, you are observing the Vedanakhanda, aggregates of feeling. You observe that. And then the third aggregate is called Sanyakhanda, okay, aggregates of perception. And in here it's not straightforward. Not straightforward. Because observed Sanyakhanda, aggregates of perception. Because perception, in a strictest sense, you simply cognize certain marks or characteristics of that object so that you always can recall or remember that object whenever you come face again. So that perception could be the right one or the wrong one. And the wrong it could be exactly its true nature. Through that nature, you cognize and you perceived. Or you could cognize and receive which is not in accordance or which is not the true nature. If it is not the true, it is the false nature, to coin a word. You perceive through a and whether we cognize it, remember it, perceived it. The more memory that way, that is perception. It is. It could be right or wrong. So in here, to put it in a different way, when you perceive it as it really is, you can call it samadhi, the correct view, the right view. When you perceive it not according to its true nature, you can call it dhiti. If you want a full word, mecha dhiti, you perceived it wrongly. So perception could be samadhi or mechadhiti, it could be. But we cannot be observing in the dual way. So when we observe this sanya, you don't and we don't observe directly. Okay? We observe indirectly. Whenever you are cognizing and remembering, okay, an object, it could be physical marks that you made with some physical aspect, physical mark. It could be the sensation that you try to associate and remember with based on your experiences. Or it could be with the emotional factors that you associate with. So whenever you are observing the physical marks or the feelings and sensations or the emotionals or formations, mental formations, which are associated with your perception, then it is correcting your wrong perception into the right perception. In a different way, how do you do that? How is perception is replaced with the proper technique of perceiving, which is mindfulness. Mindfulness, the way it's perception, it perceived, but it perceived according to its true nature as it really is. That's why the Buddha taught us this mindfulness. so that whenever we perceive something, it is always in accordance with the true nature as it really is. How do? You observe all these physical marks of physical aggregates, marks of feeling aggregates, marks of formation aggregates that are mingled or mixed with your perception. How do? That? As soon as you take the mindfulness in, as soon as you replace mindfulness with this in place of sanya, what happens is it eliminates the likes and dislikes. It eliminates lobha and dosa. Okay? In other words, you don't look at it with favoritism or prejudice. You don't look at it with partiality. You look at impartially. And also, you know exactly what is happening. That is how mindfulness cleaned out the perception sanya. So whenever you perceive something with mindfulness, automatically you are observing the true nature of the object that is arising at the moment. So one should understand that. Is the aggregates of clinging. But foundation of mindfulness, we don't say perception. Okay, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the feeling, mindfulness of the formations, and mindfulness of the consciousness. We don't say sanya. The reason is sanya is automatically replaced by mindfulness. Mindfulness is also perception, but it's every time. Because of the technique, because of the method, because how the Buddha taught us, it is always identical of the true nature of the object. That's how it is. So we're observing this, and also formation. Formation we already know. What is formation? Formation or sankhara, okay, mental formation. Formation is what is for formation is making it or forming it, forming something, making something. That is formation, forming. Formation, sankhara. You're always creating something, you're always making up something, you're always. Okay. Making something, there is the will involved. Without willingness, without the will, you won't make anything, you won't form anything. Only when you have a will to do it, you are making something, you are forming something. When you have a will to go to downtown Vancouver on a sunny day, when you have a desire, when you have a will, you somehow make it to get to downtown Vancouver and do whatever you desire or your will to do. So every sankhara or every formation, there is always a will. Will, volition, or chetana. Chetana, there's always that. That chetana itself is the one of the sankhara khanda, aggregates of formation. But in every formation, every making process, that will is involved. The will, the desire. Because of that, Something is made, something is formed, something is created. That is how it happens. So whenever you are observing anda, okay, you're observing it, and based on the direction of the will, intent of the will, and purity or impurity of the will, things will be forming successively one after the other. And whenever you're observing a sense of awareness of objects, you are observing your consciousness. So those are the things you are all the time observing, the five aggregates, because that is the job of Vipassana. So whenever you are observing the five aggregates, what are you observing? You are observing, or you are experiencing, or you are knowing suffering, because five aggregates is suffering. Suffering is five aggregates. Every time you are observing any one of the five aggregates, you are understanding dukkha. You are understanding the First Noble Truth. Of course, not with clarity, not with concept. You don't come into a big picture with intellectual construction. But you are experiencing. Every time you are observing, you are experiencing dukkha. So that's how five aggregates come into the First Noble Truth, and that's how Vipassana come into the walking model you observed. Okay, let's say we observe. When we observe, let's take an example. Okay. Suddenly you are observing, as usual, and there is a thought arises which happened a day ago, a week ago, which really provoked you and you got really tested, angry. Okay. When you got angry at that moment, what happened? Because of that anger, you couldn't hold your tongue or you couldn't hold. Which one shouldn't do. You say something that shouldn't. You did something that you shouldn't. But that is the anger. And then because of the consequences, you pay the price or minimal. You feel bad. That is, a week ago it happened. That is suffering because of the unmindful nature or heedless nature of the situation, not mindful, not heedless of the situation. And you are meditating and suddenly that anger thought arises again, and the anger arises again. As soon as the anger arises, but this time as you are meditating, you have that mindfulness momentum is on your side. Because of that, you can observe that anger. You become aware of that anger quite quickly. And as soon as you become aware of that anger quite quickly, what happens is anger is already starting to work its own gear. Suddenly, your muscles are tense, your fist a little tightened, your jaw a little tightened, and your heart racing faster because anger take control. Just drive in its own lane. That's what happened. And suddenly, mindfulness come in and you become aware. When you become aware, what do? You observe the manifestation of the anger. Let's say on a physical level, or you observe the anger itself, if you catch it fast enough. And as soon as you observe it, what happened? All these physical manifestation, first of all, decrease its momentum, and then finally disappear. The anger also disappears. And because of that, you do not have any uncomfortable, dissatisfied situation in you anymore, because that suddenly disappears. So that is the experience of your meditation. We are spotlighting on this one. You can take every instance in that nature. And as soon as it disappears, and not only once, not only twice, you've been experiencing many times and many situations, and suddenly you realize there, before I suffer, whenever that anger comes up, it suffers. When you are not meditating, that situation is so bad, whenever you think about it, you become really angry again. Of course, when you are angry, you personalize it and you just go straight onto that person in your mind and cursing and shifting and do this, do that, they are wrong. That is how it goes. Because you grasp onto that situation, you hold onto that situation, you become attached to that situation, which means you grasp that anger. You hold on that anger, you become attached to that anger. Amazingly, we become attached to the anger, which we don't want it, but still we attach to the anger. Because of that attachment, that anger arises again and again, and very uncomfortable, unpleasant feelings and thought and cursing to that person arise again and again and again. Because we grasp onto it, we can attach to it. But in your meditation, as soon as mindfulness comes in, that anger, that thought is viewed totally on an impartial level, without likes and dislikes. You view it exactly as it is anger. This is a tightening of the muscle. This is the jaw grinding. You observe it, and then everything simply dissolves. Why? At the moment of your observation, you are impartial, which means you don't have likes and dislikes. Okay? You don't have likes and dislikes. You don't have prejudice. What it means is you don't have attachment. When you don't have no likes and no dislikes, you do not have attachment to the object. You don't have grasping onto that object. You don't have holding onto that object. You don't become attached to that object. That is our personal experience. And I'm sure everyone who is sitting here have one time or the other have experienced many a time. So let's look at it. The first time before on a normal state, we are attached. We grasp, we hold on to that condition, situation, and we suffer. And when you are observing with mindfulness, you can observe the object objectively, which means you don't have any attachment. You don't have any grasping onto that condition or to the sensations or to the anger. At that moment, no suffering arises anymore. That is our personal experience. Before we attach, we are tortured by the same thought again and again. When we are able to observe the same condition, the same anger with mindfulness, it becomes detached. Detached attitude is established. as soon as detached attitude is established, there is no more suffering. In fact, don't even know where it is gone. You move on to another, rising, falling, or and so on and so on. That is our personal experience, that grasping, that attachment creates suffering. Without that grasping, without that attachment, there is no suffering. Moment to moment experience. And this attachment, this grasping, in Pali is called tanha. Okay, English translated as craving, tanha. Tanha or craving is the cause. Suffering is the effect. And we just talk about 2-3 minutes based on our own personal experience. And that's what Buddha said, the second noble truth. Craving is the cause and suffering is the effect. Okay, tanha is craving. Is the cause, and dukkha is the effect. Cause and effect. In other words, the Buddhists point out the origin of suffering. The origin of suffering is attachment, craving. Craving and attachment is the cause. Suffering is the effect. So that's how the Buddha taught us the second noble truth. The second noble truth, the origin of suffering, or the genesis of suffering, or the beginning of suffering, that is craving. Craving is the cause, suffering is the effect. But what is suffering? Suffering is the five aggregates. Craving is the cause. Five aggregates is the effect. And what is five aggregates? Five aggregates is this mind and this body. Craving is the cause. Mind and body is the effect. What is this mind and body? It is a self, a person, you, me, I, a living being. Craving is the cause. Becoming a living being is the effect. How does a living being arise? It has to be born. Craving is the cause. Rebirth is the effect. Of course, when Buddha taught us, not people like us, he taught the very people who are very already quite enlightened with great intellectuals, great wisdom. So brief and short, but throughout the century, all the great teachers have explained to us in many ways. Now we come to understand in many different ways. So each one can understand. But we must understand in such detail if we want to understand what suffering is and how craving and sufferings are connected, how the first noble truth and the second noble truth are connected. At such a way, we must understand craving is the cause, suffering. And through the connection, I have shown craving is the cause. Rebirth is the effect. Rebirth. That's how you go round and round in the cycle of birth and death and birth and death and birth and death. Samsara. Craving is the main driver. Craving is the cause. So the Buddha said, craving, this craving or this tanha, T-A-N-H-A, tanha. This craving, this tanha. Okay. This hunger and thirst. Buddha used the word thirst and hunger. Thirst and hunger, or this craving. Thirst and hunger, or this craving, is the one that created rebirth. Craving, the second noble food. This one which created rebirth. So in here, the Buddhism goal, totally different from the rest of the concepts or the ideas or beliefs or philosophy of genesis of living beings. Or you want to more precise word, genesis of human being. But in Buddhism, humans and all other livings are the same. Living being is a living being. It's just a matter of a different setting, different conditions, different. The genesis of human being or living beings are that they are involved with creators. Okay, some are with creators, some with the, or whatever one perceived to be. But it's always created. That is the origin of human or living beings. The genesis of human or living beings created. But in Buddhism, nothing is created. Everything is through cause and effect. And if you want to call it the creator of living beings, is that craving, that thirst, that hunger. That is the one that created living beings. That's the one that created rebirth. Okay. And this craving is bound up, intertwined, mixed together, inseparable with pleasure and lust. This craving is inseparably bound up with pleasure and lust. And this craving takes delights in here and there. How the Buddhists talk about the second noble truth. Okay? You become, that rebirth is caused by craving. And it is always bound up with pleasure and lust. The second noble truth. So what is mean by this rebirth, rebirth, rebirth? Life, life, life. That one is a proof. Of course, until and unless one have practiced and attained a certain mental state, okay, higher degree of concentration, that's different. But all of us have been reached to that level. So we do not have the direct proof that the past life exists or next life exists. We don't have that. So to speak, we have to take Buddha's word, faith. Okay, that is rebirth. I'm telling now scientifically. We do not have it at this stage. But there are so many things that is happening in the world under our nose which support this theory of rebirth. Okay. We all know about the prodigy. Okay, the kids, the child's only about 4, 5, 6 years old. You can play music like the grandmaster. There are some children, not even teens, they are mathematical genius. They are at the PhD level. That kind of a thing. A few years old, they can sit down and meditate like a monk who has been practicing for 20, 30, 40 years. persistently and consistently. Where does it come from? Everything has to have a cause and effect. They do not have any environment or condition or time to practice these things, to learn this thing, but regardless, it is with them. So the only logical answer is they must have a certain time period, a certain space and time that they have been practicing and learning a lot. For a 4 to 6 years old, which one is that? It's definitely past lives. That kind of support we can draw in and see that to prove indirectly that rebirth or past life and future life exists. There are some cases, okay, there's one documented one. A child born in the lower part of Burma. When he was born, he has a big scar on his back. But the parents love the child and they brought him up. When he got older and older, when you have enough common sense, what he said is, I want to go home. No, you are at home. No. And that child, to make the long story short, gave exactly, no, I live, I have a family, I have a wife, I have children, I live in such and such place, such and such time, this village and so on. And I was just trading, in those olden days you have trading with a little, not a motor boat, this is about 100 years old. So with a boat coming down the stream and a gang of robbers rob all his goods, he's a merchant, and they cut him with their sword and kill. And that big scar is exactly where it was cut. So he keeps saying that, and finally the parents gave up and okay to keep the kid shut up. So they actually traveled to exactly what the kid said, and they found exactly it was there. There was a man who lived there. They have the family of the children, everybody. Now they are a lot older, of course, than this kid. And was traveling on his trading downstream in the Irrawaddy River, he was robbed and killed. And these kind of things, there are many, many documents, not only in Burma, in the West too, in the East, in the Middle East, everywhere. Somehow or something, these kind of stories come up. So from these stories, which are quite easy to prove, rebirth exists, past life exists, and future life exists. But at the same time, if you practice meditation to a higher degree in a jhanic level, you can accurately recall your past life. While I was young, I was quite curious about these things. And I met a man who he can recall 40 of his past life. And there's no reason for me not to believe him. He's a rich man. He doesn't need anything. He doesn't even have family anymore. In a big house, he lived by himself every day. All that he do is meditate. He doesn't want a name, he doesn't want a fame, he doesn't talk with anybody, he simply meditates and lives. For some reason I got connected, and that's a story I know. He doesn't need to impress just a little kid. It's a teenager who's exploring. And I truly believe him. There are many instances, of course. So there are people, if you practice samatha meditation, and if you get to a certain jhanic level, you can have that power to recall past. And for him, it's as clear as day and night. And also in vipassana meditation, some of the yogis, not everybody, especially with people with some parami from the past, and which in turn supports what you are practicing now. Recall some past life. How do you know? Of course we don't know. But whenever you call, it is just like you see something. You see something in your mind eye as if you are looking at me and I'm looking at you. That's number one. In a real, like, let's say, virtual reality, that kind of thing. And in a place and a time that you never imagine exists, with details. Those kind of things happen quite often, and there are many reports in the meditation center as well. So the point I'm making is, there may be people who argue, maybe life exists, it doesn't exist, and so on and so forth. Rebirth. How do we know? The Buddha is very clear. Craving is caused, rebirth is a fact. Not only this, there are many lives you have lived in the past and many lives you are going to live on as long as you live in this system that creates the cycle of birth and death, which is craving. So that is a rebirth. So that is how we can indirectly prove that previous life exists and future exists. And that is... So... there's a craving, sense pleasure. Craving for sense pleasure, that's one type of craving. And another type of craving is craving for the wrong view. Craving for the wrong view. The wrong view is one, craving for the wrong view of eternalistic view, which means some of the people in the world believe we have a soul or a spirit, indestructible, lives forever for eternity. Okay? It cannot be destroyed, it is eternal. That is the eternalistic view. And these soul or spirit, they have to work their way up. In other words, they will have to cleanse themselves. And eventually, you evolve upward, 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 and eventually you become one with the, you can call it a creator, or you can call it a universe, or you, whatever, there are many words coined. You believe there is one eternal place, and you are walking towards it, and that one soul is eternal and goal. That's the eternalistic view. That is one view. And another one is called anilahistic view, I believe. In other words, this is the only life ones have. There's nothing before, and once you die, there's nothing after. That kind of a view. So people hold on to that view, crave for the eternalistic view. And some people craved and hold on to this only one life view. With those kind of three cravings, we live. And as long as we hold on these three cravings, but actually two, one, you crave onto sense pleasure, two, you crave onto the wrong view. As long craving, you will be always reborn in this cycle of birth and death. In other words, this birth is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering. If there's a birth, there will be old age, decay and death, suffering. So craving is the cause, suffering is the effect. Craving is the cause, rebirth is the effect. the Second Noble Truth. So we touch a bit of what the Second Noble Truth is. And then next talk, we'll go more detail into about this craving or tanha, or attachment, the Second Noble Truth, or the origin of suffering. May all of you be able to understand the Four Noble Truth theoretically as well as experientially, and may you be able to release yourself from all form of suffering as soon as possible. Sadhu, 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 buddham bhujemi, dhammam bhujemi, sangham bhujemi.